have been listening to reason today. We made the decision. I think what we expect the department to do is give us substantial good reasons. And then I'll allow Dr. Patel to think through the issue. And tomorrow we'll make the decision finally. You see. But I think there's a good substantial reason given. Can we go to the functions of the commission?
Thank you, Chair. We must also just remember, Chairperson, when we look at the number of commissioners, that it is not a matter that they are going to be there full-time, if we're looking at the fiscal implications as far as that is concerned. The bill at this moment determines that they should meet at least twice a year, but we must just keep in mind that it's not a matter of 10 members who's going to be in a full-time job who has to get remuneration. What we can do, of course, we can make them all members of parliament, then they can't receive any further money if they serve on the commission. So, but that's just on a light and note, Chairperson.
And I do hope that you'll wait until you arrive at that time where we decide about the remuneration. Yeah. Can we go to 62B? Is the functioning of the commission, which is the life of the commission itself. Is there anybody has got anything to do or to say about that? Mr. Honorable Khunabas?
Chairperson, I presume that at 62BD4, we will insert there the Reserve Force Council as well, because that was the request to consult with the Secretary for Defense, the Chief of the Defense Force, the Reserve Force Councils, members of the Defense Force, and other interested persons. That was, and you will remember, as far as the Act is concerned, it determines that all these things must be consultation with the Reserve Force Council. So I just want to make sure that, and I want to propose that we insert there the Reserve Force Council.
Yesterday we were talking about the division of functions of the commission, and there was a concern. I mean, the intention is that the commission be, on the one hand, independent, and that it make recommendations only. I wonder if the Secretary of Defense would consider 62BC, where the commission must ensure the effective and efficient implementations of policies. Is there not a risk there that the commission may deviate into becoming involved with what the parliamentary legal advisor yesterday referred to as operations? That's the first question. The second question, again, the Honourable Grunewald made a proposal. Does the, through you, Chair, the Secretary of Defence, not think it's a good idea that part of the functions of the commission would be to provide or to carry out a quarterly quantitative and qualitative review of the grievance system every quarter, and to report on that, of course, publicly?
Quality and quantitative?
Quantitative and qualitative analysis of the grievance system every quarter.
Secretary, you have to help us quite clearly about that. See, even in terms of, will it not affect the organogram of the SADF overall? When it comes to efficient implementation, is that not your jurisdiction? Is that not interfering? Will it not create tension in the way it's getting constructed at particular centers? Because if it's an advisory body, and then you say to it implement, then it's no more an advisory body. It becomes a body now that becomes active. And if we do it by law, it means that they can interfere and come into a department, go to any person in the department and take away books or do something. But they're implementing and they're looking for efficiency. Can you just give us an advice? Can we kill our cell phones if we can, please? I'm sorry, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. If I may start with C, because I think there's a question also around D4.
Yes.
On C, Chairperson, I think maybe let's concede that the word ensure the effective and efficient implementation is probably inappropriate. What we really mean is probably monitor. The role that the Commission has is once it has made specific recommendations, it has some responsibility around monitoring that they are being implemented. Saying ensure assumes almost that they would do, and that's not our intention. And the job of the Chief of the SNDF. And I think it's probably, we could substitute the word ensure with the word monitor. And I think that's really what we're trying to describe, their responsibilities around monitoring.
We're talking about C, Chairperson.
Okay.
Yeah, it says promote measures and set standards. So the measures and the standards must ensure the effective and efficient implementation. What's wrong with that? It's not that the Commission is actively involved as far as that is concerned. It says it promotes measures and it sets standards. So it said there. And you must ensure that the standards you set will ensure. But it's not that they are practically involved as far as that is concerned. So I don't have a problem the way it's put there at the moment.
Understanding of the committee.
Yeah, thanks, Honorable Chair. Yeah, I think it's very clear that the insurer here is not the Commission, but what is being ensured here are the standards set. So I think we can retain the terminology. I don't think it is conflicting the spirit or the letter of the Act. Now, on D, if you allow me to digress a bit, or you want us to exhaust this? All right, it's okay. Sure.
I think that would be fine. The issue, though, is whether it is deemed adequate that the balance of that clause would cater for circumstances, particularly if we go to four, in relation to the monitoring function, which would really then happen through consultation. And I think would be okay with that if the committee perceives the balance of the process referring to enabling the Commission to exercise its duties in monitoring that what they have stipulated has been carried through. Thanks.
No, you must always feel free also to advise us because you are the main implementer. So we don't want to create something that will create tension. If you could give us advice out of your own experiences, we'd have to craft it in a manner that it could give a balance within the institution itself. If you are happy, we are also good.
Okay, what I'm indicating, in fact, it's if you look at 3 and 4 together underneath D, that's the sentiment I was expressing, which is contained therein, which is about evaluating and monitoring implementation of such policies. D would indicate the mechanism for doing such through consultation with the Secretary of Defense, with the Chief of the Defense Force, and others. If you read those two together, the issues around monitoring are catered for therein. And I would like to agree, that's the sentiment I was expressing here, that if the committee is satisfied on C, that promote measures and standards, and to ensure, not the commission, but to ensure the standards and measures are meant to ensure effective implementation of the policy, then we're happy with that. Then the monitoring is taken care of later on. Thank you.
I was going to say, Committee Chairperson, I want to agree with Honorable Hunewald and Patel. General Hun, my general. You are also my general. I want to agree with them that the ensuring the effectiveness, it is the standards which will ensure, you see, that there is effective and efficient implementation of, I want to agree with them on that issue, that it is this standards which must be set, which will ensure the implementation, the effective implementation of this.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. We are on D6, consult with National Treasury. I think there's somewhere in the bill where the minister should consult with the Minister of Finance. Now, is it not a duplication of responsibility that we have the minister consulting there and we have the commission consulting there? So I just need a clarification on that.
Chair, we would not consider it as a duplication. The processes of National Treasury are very intricate and complicated, and interventions are sometimes required at levels other than the ministerial level in relation to particularly budget allocation, acceptance of particular deviations from National Treasury prescripts in relation to the exceptional circumstances, negotiations around salaries and formula for determination of such things. And what we were really, our inclusion here is intended not to exclude or bar the Commission from its ability to consult with National Treasury on those technical aspects. Because invariably the consultation with the minister would be at the level at which final proposals are tabled and the Minister of Finance would indicate support for them. But our experience would indicate that prior to that conclusion of proposals are extensive engagements at lower levels. And the Commission, if it were to deal with matters of this nature, must not be prevented from being able to engage National Treasury on some of the technical aspects of what they may or may not be wanting to advise on. And it's quite important that they have that access. Because normally what would then happen, if you exclude them from that process, they would put a proposal to the Minister of Finance. The Minister of Finance would then subject that proposal to scrutiny by officials going down. Our experience is that if you haven't negotiated with Treasury as you go up to a concluded ministerial proposal, you never succeed. And it's really to enable them to engage, if necessary, on the technical aspects of the financial side of the issues that relate to the matters contained there. Chair, if I may, the reserve for Force Council. Chair, there's a particular issue, and we thought we were going to raise this in relation to the other clause that deals with the military command issues. There is a particular perspective that is starting to emerge almost erroneously around the reserve force being different from the defense force, and we think that's potentially problematic. The Reserve Force Council is a structure that falls under the reserve and conducts its business in the context of and under the control of the chief of the defense force in its entirety. So I would propose that it would be almost superfluous to list the reserve force specifically in clause 4 when you have listed the chief of the defense force, because we are assuming it's the chief of the defense force and all of the structures under his control, including the reserve force. If you highlight the Reserve Force Council, you are not including the foundation and other structures that may well exist under the Chief of Defense Force, and that might be problematic in a sense. And it's a matter that I think we're grappling with ourselves to try and ensure that when we speak of the chief of the South African National Defence Force, we speak with respect to that and the structures that fall within that. The Reserve Force Council, of necessity, listing it specifically, I think, may create that particular challenge. Here. So, excuse me, I think Mr. Njigela wants to.
Just add on this thing, we need to be careful because the right of the Reserve Force Council to be consulted is firstly limited to matters that affect the Reserve Force, and that is already entrenched in Section 48 of the Principal Act. So one needs to always bear in mind that this is a defense amendment bill. Their right for consultation is already in Section 48, so there's no need for it to be repeated in this particular clause. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, if I look at Section 48 of the Act, Section 48, firstly, let me say, according to Section 48, it says the Minister must establish a Reserve Force Council. So it is not that it is just part of the Defence Force structures and that it is a specific structure established by the Minister. And then 48.4 says quite clearly, it says the council is a consultative and advisory body representing the reserve forces in order to promote and maintain that force as an integral part of the defense force and must, says it must be consulted on any legislation, policy, or administrative measures affecting the reserve force. And actually, Chairperson, with the submissions we had, the committee, we had a discussion on this, and we said that we're going to include them there. I can't see that it will really, if we can put them there in, because we refer to the Secretary for Defense, the Chief of the Defense Force, so why can't we just put in the Reserve Force Council? Then we ensure that we as a committee comply to 48.4, to say that any administrative measure, legislation, policy, and that is what the Commission is going to look at, that they also consulted. And let's make it sure that there's no misunderstanding as far as that is concerned. Thank you.
You haven't yet been able to work on the point that says that because they are mentioned in the Principal Act, and this is an amendment, why should we emphasize them? I mean, put them... I mean, in black and white in this particular amendment. I thought that you were just going to give us the opinion on that one. But also to say that, I mean, it does need an amendment, but also you're not dealing with the tension or the concerns that are being expressed by the Secretary of Defense, that if you go that line, you're beginning to create the reserve force. There's some force that is independent within the defense force. You haven't been able to apply your mind on that. But I don't think that they have been substantial. I'm just giving an opportunity to talk to the matter itself.
Sorry, Chairperson, on that specific issue, why I say that is that we must remember that we say we give the functions of the Commission. If we take that route to say that why do you have to mention them specifically, then why do we say that it must consult with the Secretary for Defense, the Chief of the Defense Force? Why would you say that? It's the same argument, it's just a reserved one, reversed one. I mean, if we say, well, the act, the main act stipulates, I mean, if you look at any matter of defense, then everybody should then know that you have to consult with the Secretary for Defense. Why do you put them in there? The moment you start mentioning specific structures, because that's what we are doing here, we are mentioning specifically the Secretary for Defense, the Chief of the Defense Force. And there is in the Act a specific body, the Reserve Force Councils. Council, why don't we add them there? Because if we want to mention certain specific structures, add them so that there is no misunderstanding from the side from the Commission.
No, I think the SecDef have got a quality. You know, the Secretary of Defense also gets appointed, or the chief of defense gets appointed by the president. It's a total different formation. The reserve force council is appointed by the minister as a particular body, doesn't do a certain responsibility. So when you want to argue and want to, you'll end up bringing them as equal partners. This is where the concern is. And they must not have an impression, because you gave them an opportunity to come to parliament, then automatically they want us to alleviate them to the level of the secretary of defense or the chief of defense. That's where the concern is. We don't have much information. I did say to the reserve force council, we have not been able to monitor how much work are they doing inside the reserve, the body itself. We need to apply our mind and keep on engaging them to find what it is that they are doing. But I don't say that it takes away the fact that you could mention them or you can't mention them. I'm just saying that the reserve force council in itself also has been a scarce body in front of our eyes here. We only saw them recently. No, I'm making my point now differently, but I'm taking note of the opinions and the concerns that they're expressing. I'm not going to suppress them. I'll allow them for us tomorrow when we re-exercise our mind for finality. You must have think about that. But also, as I'm saying, the SecDef and the legal division does also have good concerns that we need to be able to listen to. We'll find a balance as we go through tomorrow of how we deal with that particular matter. I would hope that all members would not forget the words of the Reserve Force Council. They don't want us to forget them. But we don't know also how many bodies are there in the Defense Force that the Secretary of Defense is referring to that might also want to be recognized. So we don't want to end up with many bodies in front of us. I hope the legal advice from Parliament, are you ready now? Now I would want to go quickly back to this document on clause 4. Have you read it?
Yes,
I've read it. Okay, Honourable Members, yesterday we were supposed to have finalised on page 4 of the bill under the salaries and entitlements. We had to work out 55.12. Now we've got additionally 3. So I just thought that we needed to sort and finish that one so that we could flow with the bill properly. We'll suspend our discussion now on 62B for the time being so that we can go back to the one that is quite crucial for us. The department has honored the decisions that we have taken yesterday. If you see the bold on 55.1, I hope everybody has got the new version of the document that has been submitted. Do you have it, Honorable Members? So 55.1, what we are going to work out is a new clause. Members of the regular force and reserve force must receive such pay, salaries, and entitlements, including allowances, disbursements, and other benefits in respect of their services, training, or duty in terms of this act as may from time to time be agreed upon in the military bargaining council. So in one, you've got one institution, the military bargaining council. If it exists, it would then have to do that responsibility. So then from N recommended, that part falls off. At number 2, if no agreement contemplated in subsection 1 can be reached in the military bargaining council, the minister may, after consideration of any advisory report by the military arbitration board, that is now your second component, the military arbitration board can also come in as advising. And then you take out the required recommended by the commission, that is taken up. And with the approval of the Minister of Finance, determines the pay, salaries, and entitlements as contemplated in the subsection. In that subsection. If that doesn't work, you then go to the third option. If the process contemplated in subsection 1 and 2 do not materialize, the minister may, on the recommendation of the commission, determine pay, salary, and entitlements with the approval of the Minister of Finance. Does that take care of every aspect that was raised yesterday? And all the concerns about the constitutionality and every process, does it take care of what the Constitutional Court have raised? Yes, I'm just verifying. I'll come to you now, Tata. Does it, then the one part I just wanted to get more clarity about, why does it have to be approval, not in consultation? Because if it's like approval, it's like you're saying to one minister, the other minister is above the other minister. Is it not, is that a correct word, approval? To my learned friends, I'll appeal for a particular. Yeah. No, no, I'm talking about three. Babu three, Tata, Okuti. Tata? Manga guy fundi, Tata, funda, Tata, Tata, funda. Funda, sisi ngeyesilisi. Kuthe kumisi ngeyesi, sinabantu basi. Fundi, sisi ngeyesi. So, funu kwenzi, nozo kwa mwena namhlanje. Ikhona ibhalwe approval. Can you give us advice on that one? Is it correct that it must be approval of the Minister of Finance?
Chair, apologies. We were really rushing to conclude this. We've made two errors in what has been submitted. If the committee may please just forgive us on that. The first is we've erroneously put approval there on three instead of in consultation. The principle remains in consultation throughout. The second error in the drafting that has happened is that the words "and approved by the minister acting in consultation with the Minister of Finance" in one after the deletion of "recommended by the commission" still exists here. It does not fall away on one. Yes, after the words bargaining council, it would say "and approved by the minister acting in consultation with the Minister of Finance." That's excluded from here, so one is not complete. We're just dealing with the issue of the commission and left out what was accepted. But I'd like us, if we're reading one in full, to reinstall those words. "And approved by the minister acting in consultation with the Minister of Finance." And then the second one is on three, to keep the principle of acting in consultation with Minister of Finance rather than approval. Even in two, the principle would remain checked throughout.
Honourable members, is that what you want to agree on? Does it satisfy you? All stakeholders, would they feel consulted within this process? This process is split into three. I would still consult with the legal advice from Parliament to check if ever it does satisfy that there can be a constitutional challenge around this one. And also it does satisfy the fact that after you've had your public hearings, unions wouldn't feel that we are pushing for de-unionization, that everybody would have been consulted. Because if you arrive at the third option, it clearly says that it is the minister only acts in her capacity when everything has been done to achieve what is not achievable, guided by what is in the objective of the bill. In the objective of the bill, which was identified very cleverly by Tatu Mlange, it says that the military bargaining council is dysfunctional at this particular moment. Now, working out of that, which you are critically being able to criticize yourself, you then arrive at these three options. You don't move. If there is a military bargaining council, would expect that military bargaining council would have been able to advise the minister. And then after that, the minister would be able to act on the issues of service conditions and that. If that doesn't happen, there's a dispute, you go to the military arbitration board. If it does exist, the minister still would comply and listen to them and take her opinions on that without the recommendation by the commission. But then finally, if nothing happens, then the commission would have to suggest to the minister how to act on providing for the resource or for the benefits of the soldier. Does that satisfy us, our learned friends from Parliament? Liga, can you give me your opinion?
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. I must, before I respond to your question, confess
I manage your issues cleverly here. Yesterday, I had to close the meeting because you pulled out our legal advisor from Parliament. Now we bring the Secretary of Defense all the way from Pretoria. Now you want to sit down and work with her here. It does disrupt the meeting. It does show a little bit an element of disrespect to Parliament. I'd really like to appeal to you to, if you do have issues, find a way of exchanging it differently. Because I don't want to stop the process, and I don't want to be like heavy on you. But really, I do quite get a little bit irritated when it's clear that other members can't talk, and it's only you and all the people that are supposed to contribute. Can I allow the? I just want to give the legal advisor from Parliament to see if he has read the issue and he understood it, and what does he think about it. Then I'll give it to all members to comment about it. Can I give you, sir?
Thank you, Chair, once again. As I said, before I deal specifically with the issues at hand, I need to confess that, look, the regime as envisaged in Section 55 is a little bit strange. In subsection 1, if one reads the amendment, what has been taken out is the end recommended by the commission to the minister. If I'm not mistaken, it might even just stop before that, recommended to. Recommended by the commission too, because what then we're told is that the minister acting in consultation with the Minister of Finance must still remain. But if we were to go back to discussions yesterday, what is envisaged in the Military Bargaining Council, wherein we spent a lot of time yesterday, it was agreed that both the employer and the organized labor should be represented in the Military Bargaining Council. One therefore presupposes that the representatives of the minister in the employer in the Military Bargaining Council should carry along to the Military Bargaining Council a mandate from the minister as the employer. And if then the minister must send a delegation to the Military Bargaining Council, and there is an agreement at that Military Bargaining Council, but it must still go back to the minister for the minister to say, I must still consult with the Minister of Finance to see if this particular agreement is feasible to implement. I hope I'm wrong in my interpretation of this, and I hope it is clarified that the agreement that will be reached at the Military Bargaining Council will remain an agreement that will be implemented. I will pause at this stage because I see that the SecDef wants to respond. With your permission, Chair.
I'm sorry. I gave you the permission to talk to this issue because I want you to apply. This SecDef is very enthusiastic. We'll give an opportunity. Don't get intimidated now. What about intimidation, gentlemen? How could we be in Panagut?
No, be guaranteed, I am not intimidated. Yes. Then there is a second provision. If no agreement is reached at the Military Bargaining Council, and then a dispute is declared, this matter should now go to the Military Arbitration Board. Now, I must hasten to point out that this act did not or does not deal with the composition of the Military Arbitration Board. This is a matter dealt with in the regulations. And in the regulations, the Constitutional Court, because the regulations give the minister the power to appoint the members of the Military Arbitration Board. And the Constitutional Court in Sandu, I think this case is well known in the defense cycles. The Constitutional Court declared the composition of that structure unconstitutional because of the perceived biasness of the members appointed into that body. So that is another factor we need to look at. The other challenge is this military arbitration board does not, like other arbitration board, makes a final binding decision. It issues an advisory report, which then must go to the minister for the minister to agree or disagree. The composition and the giving of the minister, the employer, second bite of the cherry, one is to look at is that fair labor practice as required by Section 23 of the Constitution, to which the Defense Force and its members are bound. Coming then to the third subsection that is inserted. When you legislate because there is a mischief you want to address. Now, what is the mischief that we are persuaded to address? The mischief is the dysfunctionality of the Military Bargaining Council. Why is it dysfunctional? It's dysfunctional amongst other reasons, because a threshold has been set. The circumstances of surrounding that threshold, I am unfortunately not aware and consequently cannot advise on. I've been told there is a threshold, and it would seem organized labor, individually or collectively, are struggling to meet that threshold. What is then suggested is for the legislature to empower the minister in the event the Military Bargaining Council cannot function because, for whatever reason, that the minister should effectively, this is what the essence of this province is, should unilaterally determine salaries and other conditions of service affecting members of the Defense Force. And the legal question is, will that make the bill vulnerable to constitutional challenges? I just want to refer to the same Sandu versus Minister of Defense case. I think the reference is 2007. It's Volume 9, the BLLR 785 Constitutional Law, Constitutional Court decision. The Defense Force had, in this instance, issued regulations in respect of disputed conditions of service, which the union was clearly not happy with and took the matter to court. One of the critical issues was whether the department or the department as the employer could unilaterally implement those disputed conditions of service. And this is what the Constitutional Court had to say. And I quote, "The unilateral implementation of disputed policies on matters directly related to employees' conditions of service is not conducive to healthy labor relations. The promotion of which was one of the objectives of the regulation." If the SANDF's attitude were to be accepted, the employer would be entitled to unilaterally implement decisions over the objections of the union. This would undermine the very purpose of the regulations, unquote. Now, this gives an indication that the Constitutional Court would not take kindly to proposed amendments of this nature. It is my submission. Thank you, sir.
That's the submissions, members of parliament from all parties. Can I put it over to you to apply your mind? Yeah, I know. See, parliament, the legislators must know that they are here to legislate. And it's tough sometimes. That's your challenge. What do we do now? Here is the legislation in front of us, and here are the challenges that we are presented with. Because we have said to ourselves that we wouldn't want to pass the legislation that wouldn't pass the Constitutional Court. Unions have threatened that if we do that, that takes away their own right. They would take it up and take us to the Constitutional Court. We are confronted with that particular challenge. Now, we have thought that this 55.1.2.3 is getting us nearer to resolving this particular matter. Apply your mind so that when you take the decision, you must know that it's your decision. It's a parliamentary decision. It's not the departmental decision or anybody else, but you have done it quite conscious amongst yourself of what you are getting confronted with. Dr. Mlangi.
You see, if every time we have to legislate in order to alleviate or help or improve the position of our people in the country, if every time we have to do that, we say, hey, man, are we not going to be taken to court for trying to help our people? If that's how we're going to operate, I don't think we'll succeed in doing anything. There is a problem with which the department is faced. Complaints from people, men and women in the uniform. They want their salaries increased, their conditions of service improved, and so on and so forth. We make a law and say we will provide you with certain procedures which must be followed. First of all, we say 55.1. These are the procedures which must be followed in solving this problem. We are giving the representatives of the workers, of people in who are complaining. The unions, if you want to, I didn't want to use the word union. These are the procedures which must be followed before considerations on improving your salaries, etc., can be made. You've got to have to be reorganized. You've got to have so many members in your union which you are representing, say 5,000. If you do not have such number, then we are not going to recognize you as a union. Meet that number. Once you've met that number, you have, on the one hand, reps from the department who will bargain with you That doesn't take place. They don't meet the requirement. But we have made provision in Parliament that these are the steps you must follow. We have made that provision. You don't meet the first provision. So second provision will also fall off because you could not meet the requirement of 51.1, 55.1. So the second provision will also fall. But Parliament will have protected itself. We have said, we have made these provisions. Parliament is protecting itself by provision 2, that if this fails, what do we do? That's where the said provision comes in. And say, if 1 and 2, for whatever reason, do not materialize, do not take place, what is the minister to do? There are people complaining. People are suffering, and we want to improve their conditions. Any court of law, we should not be interested in Parliament as a structure in improving the conditions of people. I don't regard it as a law, as a court of law. I can't regard it as a court of law. Court of law must sit to justice. People are complaining. Justice must be done. And here Parliament is trying to do justice by improving the conditions of people. Say, if 1 and 2 do not materialize, option 1 and 2 do not materialize, which we have protected ourselves. If you don't do it, then we will do it on our own. I want to see a court say, no, Minister, you can't improve, you can't even naturally improve the conditions of people after having consulted so and so and so and so and so and so. So personally, I think, from the chairperson, that the third edition, the third option, as put forward to us by the Secretary for Defense, meets the requirement. I want to see the court saying, Minister, you had no right to unilaterally decide to improve the conditions of people after we had given, provided for 1 and 2 to take place. And if they fail, it's not the Parliament's business. It's not the Minister's business. Our concern is to improve the conditions of people. Jabulani.
Chairperson, I carefully listened to what the legal advisor from Parliament said. What the proposal is actually here is that we leave Section 55.1 and 2 as it is in the Act at the moment. This is the recommendation here, the new one. And then we add a third subclause. Now, Chairperson, what we are doing with the adding of the subclause, we want to use the Commission as a tool to solve a dispute, a labor dispute. That is what this clause is actually doing. Because we say that if the process is contemplated in subsection 1 and 2 and do not materialize, then the Minister may use the recommendations of the Commission. Now, Chairperson, I feel that we are actually compromising the Commission. We should take it out. Completely. Number 3. We should leave Section 55.1 and 2 as it is in the Act. And the reason I say that, Chairperson, is why do we want to bring in the Commission here? Because if we look at Section or Clause 5 of the Bill, 62B, the functions of the Commission, I said that actually yesterday, it says the Commission must, the first one is, A, on an annual basis make recommendations to the Minister on improvements on salaries and services benefits of members. So there is already, the function of the Commission is already to make recommendations to the Minister, besides these other sections. So if the Commission do the work it's supposed to do, then it will make recommendations. So then it is for the minister to decide how she is going to use those recommendations. But we must not put something in the Act that can compromise the commission, because we've heard, and there's a problem with the regulations, but the department will have to go and solve that out. If I listen to what the court case of the Constitutional Court, I feel very strongly that we don't use the commission as a tool to solve that. It's already going to make recommendations, and it's for the minister how she's going to use that. Thank you.
Thanks for the new title. Well, after listening to our legal advisor, I think that we should retain the Act without any beautification or addition. That is, if indeed the minister is represented in the military bargaining council, so why the consultation at a later stage? So my suggestion, actually it's not a suggestion, I support and concur with Honorable Grunewald that we don't even need 55.3. We should just get rid of it, and all the wordiness in 55.1 and approved by the minister acting in consultation with, that is, I suppose that we should retain as it is in the original Act and stop all these beautifications.
Okay, just picking up on a comment, and I think that we should always bear in mind when we're dealing with this legislation that the mischief that we're trying to remedy is the poor service conditions within the Defence Force. So we need to keep our eye on the ball, and it's not the Constitutional Court that are responsible for the poor service conditions that we find in the Defence Force today. That's just a comment. I think my understanding is that the proposal, which seemed to me very sensible yesterday, was that we leave Section 55 unamended. That was the Honorable Grunewald, if I recall correctly, that was his proposal. And that is a constitution that would certainly pass constitutional muster and would ensure that this bill doesn't boomerang back into Parliament. But I wonder whether it would not be a good idea to consider amending Section 2 just simply to say that if there is no agreement, then the minister would consider any advisory report by the Military Arbitration Board, and she would also consider a report or an advisory report by the National Defence Force Service Commission, and then with the approval of the minister, determine pay, salaries, etc., contemplated in the section. So it would then mean that if no agreement was reached, the minister would consider a report from the military arbitration board, from the National Defence Force Service Commission, and then with the approval of the Minister of Finance, set salaries. I think that would be an elegant solution, which I hope the parliamentary advisor would confirm would pass constitutional muster.
But let me flip-flap or check some few issues before I take another round.
Before you do that, just on that question.
No, I'll give you I just wanted you to comment after I finish that. I know you work out of experience. You know, I agree with you, Honorable David, to say that we're supposed to deal with poor service conditions of the soldiers. You know, out of history, it's what now is not reflected. but that is getting forgotten in the mindset of those that have worked on the FNDF bills for some time, that the imposition essentially of the Constitutional Court of that 20 regulation, it's an imposition on the FNDF. And it has weakened us for a very long time. It has put us against conditions that we have not foreseen for a very long time as a country. We do recognize constitutional matters. We do respect the Constitution. We do respect the Constitutional Court. But it has unionized the FNDF. And I had said it from day one, that that is the challenge that members of Parliament would have to take on and take it head on. That clearly here, the Constitutional Court had put us against the wall. You see. And we had hoped for years that we'll improve that situation through legislation. And that is the challenge that they're faced with, that you must legislate either to continue unionizing the FNDF or take that out and face that challenge with the Constitutional Court and confront the Constitutional Court. That's the first biggest challenge, which means that, which has been a view that has been exercised and been debated since the Hoedbom case, that is it the prerequisite of the Constitutional Court to instruct parliamentarians how to behave and how to engage into the law itself. That's a particular challenge, that the Constitutional Court goes and defines the social conditions. And after that, the Constitutional Court says to you, go and improve, go and build a house. Now, that also tempers within a constitutional state about that, that what is the relationship that exists between Parliament, the judiciary, and the executive. Now, as Parliament, at this particular moment, we are being called upon to exercise our mind. Clearly, is this the type of relationship that should continue within the environment, within the democracy that is being exercised within the South African context? That's how far that issue is. It's not a beautification issue that impartially. It's a very serious issue. That's how I take it serious. That's why I have purposely allowed all legal representatives to apply their mind, because I knew historically that that's where the issue is. That's where the issue is. It is about the unionization of the FNDF. And we have raised that issue. We have explained it. We have taken that challenge. We have agreed as members of Parliament here for a very long time that we need to be able to either agree that we will never allow unionization to take place. So even the argument of saying, what is the capacity of the arbitration board? What is the capacity of the Military Bargaining Council to us as legislators? Is that what we should obsess ourselves about? Or is it about we do give opportunity in the words of of Honorable Mlangeni to say, we give you, if you exist as a stakeholder within the FNDF, go to the Military Bargaining Council. If you exist and have reached a threshold, go to the arbitration board. But if you can't, why should it be a parliamentary obligation or a departmental obligation to put up that particular position? It's not our job. And we would never be able to legislate from here to say, go and form a union from here and be able to exist so that the arbitration board. Because I'm saying this, honorable members, you know, when you want to do a law and somebody comes out quite frankly and honest, but what the department has done, they say, after all our assessment and all our experiences within the within the department in setting up this objective, we say in 2.5, in order to relieve the defense force from depending solely on the largely dysfunctional bargaining process, which is the biggest challenge, it has been imposed by the Constitutional Court upon them. And we have agreed, we have tried to see if we can work through that particular process, but it is not working. What do we expect us to do at this particular moment? This is where Honorable Mlangeni comes in and says, it becomes difficult for one sphere or one arm of government to say to the other arm of government, get it to work. You see? But what the Constitutional Court is telling us here as members of Parliament get that military bargaining council to work. And the department that accounts to us says to us, it's not possible. We have tried it. This is not the 15th year. And in the 15th or 16th year of this parliament or of this democracy, we faced with a strike of our own constituency that is accounting to us of parliament of the SNTF. Striking, which has never happened historically for a very long time. It shocked the whole country and it shocked the world that that type of an environment has developed because of service conditions. Now we are trying to do a legislation that is trying to address that, is trying to go to the bottom of that. At this moment where the soldiers are going to rely on our strength and our thinking, we seem to be wishy-washy as legislators. We seem not to be able to be decisive of what we want to do. I'm just saying, I'm giving it over to you as the chair of the committee. Think about these things. That there's an ordinary soldier who runs up and down, who doesn't have conditions that could meet, that could be met through all other processes. He can't go to a union. He can't go to the military bargaining council. But his conditions remain detrimental to him. And he only carries his loyalty to our own country. He's a patriot. He's prepared to serve the constitution. But he's just saying that can parliamentarians at one moment of their own lives make it possible for them to meet and improve their own conditions? And we seem not to be clear of what we want to do. We do have the resources as parliamentarians. If it then means that we have to set ourselves up against the Constitutional Court, it means us legislating. That's the biggest challenge I want you to be very conscious about, that as you take this decision tomorrow, be fairly aware that this is the challenge that they're faced with at this particular moment. You either, I don't say that be reckless and dismiss the Constitutional Court, but I also don't say be reckless in how you abandon the life of an ordinary soldier who doesn't know wherever he's going to appeal when there's a dysfunctional military bargaining council which hasn't been able to make it possible for unions to reach the threshold. So politically, you're faced with that bigger challenge. And that leadership can only be provided by Parliament at this particular moment. The hard part of life, you can't go back to the Constitutional Court, but the hard part of life is that you are the decider, you are the decision-making body that has to make this particular legislation possible. Because the department can argue more or less. It says to you, the Military Bargaining Council, in 15 to 20 years that they've been imposed upon them, it's not working. And this is the challenges that we are presenting to you now. That this is what we are in. And I've allowed the parliamentary legal advisor to advise you and speak to you about that. Now, I need his attention, Comrade Mazia. I need his attention because, you see, he is outlining all fair labor practices and everything. I just wanted to be able to tell us that as parliament, because we are confronted with this problem, beyond this one, there's no other body. The president definitely so, because he also can't legislate. He's going to send it back to parliament. Are we willing to dance and swing between the two? Because when we send it to the president says it won't stand in the Constitutional Court. When it comes back here, what will Parliament do? Well, the department, as it sits here at this particular moment, is expressed from its bottom of its own heart as a department that it has faced a difficulty to get the Military Bargaining Council to act. And I saw that finally yesterday when we tested again with the minister and the ministry, the minister says to us on clause 3, I'm willing to take that bite. When it comes to the difficulty that he's getting confronted with of resolving the day-to-day problems that are confronting the soldiers. He says, put me there at clause 3 and allow me to act. I'll act on the basis of the mandate given by Parliament. That's what that thing says. I understand all the languages of fair labor practice and whatnot, but there's a huge responsibility, members of Parliament, that is being put upon your soldiers. That's why we had agreed on forming of this of the service commission and try to identify this as a body that would be unique, because after a lot of thinking in the department, it has become very difficult through the public service commission and respecting all labor relations law within the public service commission, it has become very difficult to be able to take an improved conditions of the soldiers in the manner that would have been done. So I'm saying, no, I understand Masia and everybody wants to talk. I just thought that let's bring this thing back to where it belongs. There has been a lot of motivation, not simple beautification languages that are looked upon, but it does carry a lot of burden. And I want members, when they come into the next round, and when they make this decision, or whatever decision you make, you must consider the life of an ordinary soldier. You must also consider the democratic practices in our country, that you do have a responsibility not to dismiss or undermine the Constitutional Court, but think about every process that would strengthen the democracy, but also make it possible for our own, soldiers, the constituency that you represent, to feel that they are protected and guarded by the processes in South Africa. If you go to the situation in the borders, we have seen exactly what has gone to those soldiers, and they've been trying to be very patient this past 15 years, and it's been difficult for them. They've been ignored. And I'm putting it on your own consciousness. As you make that decision, make it quite clear that it's a decision that has got loads of ramifications for all the systems that we have created in the past 15 to 16 years. Babu Mlangeni, you wanted to say something. I'll give you that impact help. I'll give. Okay. Can I start with Stella? She feels very new.
Thank you, Chairperson. If the ANC would like to request a 5-minute break, then come back with the matter. Thank you.
Can you give us just 10 minutes, please, if you don't mind, all members, with due respect. Atum Toro, I'll take note of you as you come back. I'll give you the chance when you come back. I just want to give a 10 minutes break. You want to say something? No, the media is beginning to write that David is an underground member of the ANC. Can I give you an opportunity, David?
I'd just like to confirm that I'm in fact not an underground member of the ANC, Chair. But perhaps the Chair would enlighten us as to what took place at the meeting.
Are we agreeing on our approach here now? I was trying to work out that. Is there any other member who wants to say something, I guess, so that we could be able to move forward? I'll come back to the ANC. Duman, Honorable, can I give you over there?
Just before we were evicted from the room,
you were about language yesterday. English that you use is too hard sometimes, and the ruling party likes you, so please don't do this to them.
Okay. Just before we were asked to leave the room, Chair, you were talking about the question of unions. Now, it's my understanding that the Defense Amendment Bill, or the primary thrust of the Defense Amendment Bill, is to set up a National Defense Force Service Commission. And there's an appetite in this committee to get that done. The question of unions, I mean, there can be no greater advocate of de-unionizing the military than myself. But I've understood that that would be a separate process, which I would hope would be fast-tracked. But it seems to me if we're going to conflate the two, we may get into some trouble and then not succeed in fact getting the National Defence Force Service Commission set up timelessly.
Becoming historical in conceptualizing things properly. Is there any other member that wants to say anything? So that if members don't have much to say, it will then say, oh, that's all.
Thank you very much, Committee Chairperson. You know, I've got a little knowledge on the defense and so on. You know, Committee Chairperson, you are talking about the condition.
I like you. It's either that bottle will make me not to see the whole of you. Okay. I know you are a very beautiful friend. I want them to see it.
I'm a big man like a Samson. I was saying, Chairperson, you were talking about working condition in the army. I say myself, I've got a little knowledge on the defense. But you know, on our side visit in Messina, in Bobo province, you know, it was a contradiction amongst ourselves and some leadership of army there, because we were talking about working condition, and I don't know the rank of them. Some other boss of those group said, no, the soldiers can't leave a place where it's luxury. But others, they say, no, can't be like that. And I was confused because this man, he said, no, a soldier can't live on luxury place. Oh, it's the right place for army. But now I just found out, as a man, as a person, to say I don't have understanding about this symbol for army. My question is that some other country, internationally, how they communicated this kind of problem in the army? You know, and because I just find out on that. You know, I was looking, some of us, those other comrades who came from exile or the former uproar MK like that, they were debating. They were saying, no, can't be like that, our member to stay like this. This one said, no, soldiers can't stay in luxury place. And some of them, they say that. You know, I was confused because I don't even know who's right, who's wrong. But now, another thing from a chairperson, you know, this thing of, you know, my personal life, I think we as legislators, we must push, carry on. Because I think as South Africans, all of us, we must revisit our constitution next time. Because now, you know, we are. It's a terrible. You know, I remember in Mark building, the young man of other union said to us, if you are not involving us on this bill, we are going to challenge you in constitutional court. It was like that. But I think we must push. We must do our work. Truly speaking, you know, I was asking this question to minister one day, but I was looking minister the answer, because I was saying continental and international, which country will have a union in the army. She was saying, answer to me, you must go to ask your president Terra. But I was not satisfied, but I'm trying to say this of unionized citizens is not right. We must try the South Africans. Also, the army people, they must understand. Lastly, you know, this Bill of Rights, sometimes, as an individual, we are using upside down sometimes. I was talking to my sister here outside. We visited Portsmouth. I met him from an example. The chaplain of Tennis Bloom called young people there, 18, 20 years. They say, Reverend, can you address the young people? I would say, what did you offend you? Say, I'm still a brave in checkers and so on, so on, so on. Why you steal? He say, I was angry. I asked the other one, you say, I'm raped. Why you raped? He said to me also, I was angry. You could change it. Because these people, all these people, they are talking about Bill of Rights. You know, I say, Jefferson, you know, I was talking to talk to my wife, let's say, as a young man, 1960. And she didn't agree. And then 1966, she agreed after 6 years. We didn't say, why you do this kind of thing? You know, Jefferson, I'm trying to show this same picture of this. And also, people of South Africa, they must also understand our difficulty. And, well, I'm saying, the union also, they must also understand our difficulty. They mustn't just push, we'll take your constitutional court and all those things. I'm telling you, they must also try to think about this issue. As a legislator, let's carry on, Jefferson. And if there is a problem tomorrow or when, we'll face that problem. We will let the South Africans. We'll look that problem. How can we also solve that kind of problem? Because we can't just wait and just relax because there is somebody who intimidates and say, if you do this, go to the constitutional court. It's just my comment on that, Chairman. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. We think that Section 55 in total has been concluded with subsection 1, 2, and 3. And we are saying that in the sense that, Chairperson, our intention is not to get rid of any person, but our intention is to allow the minister to work where there is a vacancy. Now, if there is absence of structures in certain levels of negotiations, obviously the minister will not just stand and look, but her responsibility is to make sure that the department functions and the soldiers are happy as the custodian of the department. Now, I would want to suggest, Chairperson, that I know it is not the time now for us to endorse, but that we accept that we have exhausted on this section and we move on.
So you would say that 55, 1, 2, 3 would stand as they are with some language arrangements properly done, and then tomorrow when we adopt it, it should be like standing like that, this 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, well, Chairperson, you know, writing is not my skill.
Yes, I know that.
So, yes, those that have got skills and they understand the language better will always give us the correct face of appearance.
Okay. Now, I sincere, and I know your skills. I think we'll... So what it does mean, honorable members, we have now exhausted our own discussions. Nobody is saying 55, 1, 2, and 3. Our concerns would be corrected and will be looked into. And then tomorrow when we're supposed to vote, I just hope that everybody would have in totality have understood. And I like the qualification from Honorable Mazia that says 3 will only be applicable when there's a real disaster in the department, when all the other bodies are not able to work for the institution. If the Military Bargaining Council can't sit as what is prescribed in the objectives of the bill, and it's quite clear that 2 can't exist when 1 is not even there, because you do arbitration when the Military Bargaining Council is functioning. If that doesn't happen at all, the minister, we are empowering her by law to act on behalf of the department and sort out the service conditions of the soldiers as she gets anything fit. And then it doesn't then automatically also say that you don't then recognize, because we can't prescribe for cabinet, for the executive, what to do. Cabinet have got its own ways of how it runs and make sure that things happen. But we go as far as ourselves as Parliament to give the mandate within the limitations of our own powers. I'll leave it there, and then I'll give you an opportunity to reflect on it tomorrow morning. We're on the voting process. So it means that's the final stage. And if there's any other issue you want to satisfy yourself, you should do that. Now, where we were before, oh, David?
Chair, three points. The first is, it strikes me that if you look at the Principal Act, I mean, if there was no agreement in the Military Bargaining Council, and if there was a scenario where, which you described as a crisis because of the dysfunctional bargaining process, the minister isn't empowered in terms of the Principal Act to make a final decision with the approval of the Minister of Finance. That's my reading of the Principal Act. I think that it would be useful if we could get the final drafting that the department are proposing in respect to 55, 1, 2, and 3, so that we know what we're talking about. The last point, just on 55.3, which I did not have an occasion to raise before the break, is the proposed amendment reads, if the processes contemplated in subsection 1 and 2 do not materialize, the minister may, on the recommendation of the commission, determine pay. In that formulation suggests that the minister must, on the recommendation of the service commission, make proposed pay and salary and benefits. I mean, it would presumably, what I would suggest the department's intention is that the minister would make recommendations after consultation with the Defence Force Service Commission. I'm just concerned in the drafting that the suggestion would be that the minister must make recommendations, but only those recommendations made by the Defence Force Service Commission. Or the minister must decide, with the approval of the Minister of Finance, pay and salaries and entitlements, but on the recommendation of the Defence Force Service Commission. I'm not sure that that's the department's...
No, I thought that we'll leave it there so that the legal people could apply.
Okay.
But take note of what Honourable Kronabart have raised earlier, that if you go to 62B, you look at the functions of the commission, that's part of their main function that they're supposed to do that. Now, Honourable Kronabart has felt that why bring in the commission, because you then just say the minister, because it would be the responsibility of the commission to have already started to advise the minister as part of their responsibility. I'm just saying that all those considerations, we will leave it to the department and the legal people to bring everything together, just saying, so that tomorrow when we start the process, if there's any other thing,
just
consider all our opinions. Okay.
Chair, all I was suggesting is that perhaps the department would have a look at a careful formulation of the use of the words on. The last point I wanted to make, Chair, is the import of this amendment does have constitutional implications, and it would seem to me that we should, once the department's final amendments are drafted, we should try to get legal advice, or we should take legal advice at least from Parliament's legal advisor about whether, in their opinion, the amendments will pass constitutional muster, so that we are properly able to assess the risk.
No, I thought that the fact that they are here and the fact that they've been contributing to our own thinking for us to arrive at this particular level is because since yesterday, the legal advice from Parliament has been providing his inputs. So we've been quite fair and balanced in trying to get towards a decision that could become a decision of Parliament. So that he himself, in the way sometimes he was hard and crude about what he thinks is going on, is fairly protected because we have asked him to be like that, that be robust with us, don't hide to us anything, be honest, and tell us if we are transgressing the Constitution or not, so that members of Parliament, the decision lies with them. desires, and the department has made its submission, he has made his submission, but definitely so, when everything is finished, tomorrow we'll ask him for the last time, what does he think? Because he's the only one who's going to go to the Constitutional Court. We would have passed the law in the way we understood it, and if he has to battle, he will have to battle on behalf of Parliament, but would have made a decision by then. Honourable members, given the clarity that has been solicited by members, I would allow the process to go ahead now. Let's go to 62C of the, I hope we're finished. 62C, right now in the functions, we finished with the function of the commission. So we will go on to the appointment of members of commission and conditions of service. Is there anything that you think you want to say into that wording? We'll finish it for David. Don't come back to it now. Okay, that's fine. Let's go.
Chair, I'm sorry to try your patience, but I'd like to come back to 62B. I understand that clause, we've moved on from clause 4. Chair, the 62B3 gives the Commission powers to request assistance from the Department. And it would seem to me that if we step back and consider scenarios that might arise practically in the future, it seems to me that the Commission may from time to time require information from the Department of Defense. And it also seems to me that from time to time the Department of Defense will refuse to provide that information or refuse to provide it timeously. And so it raises a question about the powers that the Commission should have to access information. And my question is, given the Defense Amendment Bill, the bill's current drafting, it would seem to me that the powers that the Commission have are fairly limited. I would think that the Commission should have similar powers, to example, to the Inspector General, and be able to request information and, in fact, compel the Department to provide it. I've put that to the
committee. What are you saying, David? Are you saying that these powers must be given to... Are you saying the Inspector General has got these powers? I didn't hear you properly.
Simply put, Chair, if you look at 62B3, the Commission seems to have limited powers to access information in respect of the Department. I think that we should look at strengthening those powers, and I believe that the Commission should probably have powers similar to an Inspector General. In other words, if the Department does not cooperate, then they must be compelled to cooperate.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I understand what Honourable Maneri is saying, but I think it defeats the very reason and logic why this commission is there, because it's basically adversary. So now if we're going to give them the power to summon, I don't think it's going to work. More so that the commission, in consultation with the minister, I think those powers or that discretion suffices. We should not say we are going to empower them or the commission to summon somebody. So I think we should retain the clause as it is.
I'll talk to you about one experience without saying yes or no. You know, the biggest body in this country that has been monitored are the police. We went with that type of enthusiasm to ask the police, and we put everybody to monitor the police. Ended up that the police couldn't even function. They ended up accounting to so many bodies that they themselves have started to forget their own responsibility. So in recent times, in recent years, we've been trying to reverse that environment where there's too much monitoring. But we as Parliament, while we're monitoring even the commission, we're also monitoring the same soldiers. I mean, the minister is doing it, the secretary of defense is doing it. I mean, there's too many people are going to know. Why do you want to end up with a commission that has got also huge power to start harassing, I mean, the soldier. You'll end up with soldiers who that will end up not knowing what to do because we've all got this prescribed right over them. I'm just saying that that is your biggest challenge if you start having everybody doing that. For me, the other thing that you always have to be flexible and fairly aware of is not to create this, as Honorable Kwatela is saying, to give too much, you know, where this commission becomes now too huge in the department. It undermines the Secretary of Defense because it's got the backing of the minister. It interferes in the department without the knowledge of the ministry or without the knowledge of even the Secretary of Defense. I would want us to maintain it in that level where there is consultation. It is only when the minister have deemed it fit that they have to go into that particular area. There are issues really of confidentiality that has to be always be maintained within the SNDF. And if you are going to give a commission that power to interfere with them, you might find that it's not even, they should not even have got that information at that particular moment. There it goes and it becomes a problem. It compromises the security of the country. So it's very much important that we maintain it. The IG is purposeful that you have given it that capacity within the department, within the operational side of the defense. But if you take that power and give it to some commission of about 10 people, anything can happen there and you'll pay very costly as a country for that particular development. Maybe we should really sustain and keep it in the manner it is. I know you like transparency, but be flexible and consider security and substation. I'm just putting that opinion. I'm not saying that it's not. Members of Parliament will decide about it. Any other thing? Or do you want to say something, Secretary of Defense?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think we would be of the view that subsection 3, as it is worded, is appropriately worded. It does place an obligation in the last part on the person in the department or employee to provide the necessary assistance. And that obligation is a mechanism. It's intended. We deliberately put that last part in order to place an obligation on the person who's being required to assist the commission with information or functions, etc. And we think that obligation, if it's written in law as it is adequate to create that safeguard. Thank you, Chair.
The one part, if you are finished on this one, that I see doesn't look like you wanted to still say something? Say something, David?
The question here would be, what would the sanction be if the person or the department, in fact, did not decide to oblige?
Now that one is a separate one. Yeah, you argue three. The sanction would arise as you proceed with the bill and see if ever there's any sanction that you want to propose. Yeah. No, I'm saying that you...
Chairperson, it becomes a problem if we want to begin to be predictive. You see, it becomes a problem. And if we are doing that, obviously what we are saying is that even in our families, when you have to do groceries, you get hesitant whether to buy milk or sugar. No, he's next to me. He can hear me. Yeah, you see, when you do your groceries, you have to be undecided whether they will accept sugar or milk. This is what David is doing, and I don't think we will do that.
My point is I'm not being predictive, Chair. I'm dealing with the reality. And the reality is that the department has a very strong reputation for not being transparent and for resisting providing information. Now, if the department resists providing information to Parliament, my expectation is that the department will resist providing information to the Commission.
No, David, let's close the matter there. Let's close the matter there. You've made your point. You've understood yourself. Yeah. Let's go to 66. 2C, appointment of members of commission and condition. It gets paid to make all these good points and bad points also. Can we go to 62C, which will end at, yeah, the whole page there. Is there any member who's got an opinion, who's got a review? You must have appointment of a nomination committee, and the nomination committee can nominate Kaipas Hosana to become a commissioner, and we put him to the process, and he becomes one of the commission members. Is that the process we want to agree on, honorable members?
No,
no, you must raise your hands, you know, one of the ANC here. This is parliament. Okay, put your finger up there, Tata. Or Masia.
No, Chairperson, we thought that when we are silent, we are indicating to you that we are satisfied.
See what you said yesterday.
Yes, sir.
Silence means. Well, I have to. Yeah, 62C, 3A. He talks about broad representativity, but goes on to say males and females. Is there a need for emphasis? Because as far as I understand, when you say something is broadly representative, you can even go beyond gender and include other things.
No, I'm not saying other things. I think the emphasis should go on and even emphasize disabilities.
Yes.
Yes. Let's put that one also, so that you it doesn't become just kept broad. But let's make sure we emphasize that. I think you've identified very good. Yes. But we we'll just have to add up that it's called disabilities now. We should put that one.
But not forgetting that it is not always correct to identify weaknesses of individuals. So I think male and females is covered. Whether all the other areas are applicable, they will apply as it is constituted.
Thank you, Jay. Maybe I miss it, but I don't see in 62C the number of members of the nomination committee. It says the minister must appoint a nomination committee to make the recommendation. But it doesn't say, then it says representative of that and that. But I don't see in this clause how many members do we have on the nomination committee. And I think that should be specified. Well, say at least 5 or 6 people.
Okay.
Because that is only the nomination committee that is going to be there.
Honorable Number?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you to the Honorable Honorable. Because I also noted that there was no number. I'll also move that we put 5 people and the gender also be considered on that number.
You have a problem with that one. Can you go to 62D, disqualification from membership and removal from office? Or David?
Chair, I wanted to make 2 points on 62C, but going back to 62B, we could always test the reality. I could put a few questions to the Secretary of Defense and see how she... 62C, Chair. Yesterday I raised the question of the objective of the bill, and the objective of the bill is to set up an independent National Defense Force Service Commission, the operative word being independent. Now, there is an independent test which has arisen out of constitutional court judgments, and one of the tests is looking at how members of the commission are appointed. Now, I've urged you, Chair, to get our legal advisors to brief us on how one would test the independence of an institution so that we can compare what is being proposed here with the independence test. Now, if you look at the selection of, or the proposal for the selection of the commission, I mean, this gives the minister enormous power, and I believe could compromise the independence of the National Defense Force Service Commission. And I believe, therefore, that what we need to do is to take some time out to look at how other commissions are, in fact, appointed. And in this process, to give Parliament more power or look for an alternative mechanism to make sure that the appointment process is independent. I think we could look at several other institutions, but it would require our research staff to look at two or three examples and for us to compare what is being proposed in this bill with those institutional mechanisms. And there might be some good ideas that might assist us to achieve the objective of this bill. That's the first point. The second point,
clarify the one point. No, I was just saying to you, I have taken note and I've asked the law and legal advisor to look into that. The only handicap that he has is that he has to spend most time here also listening to us so that he could be able to give us some time, I mean, and some advice. So he then said that if I give him an opportunity to do his work until tomorrow, by the time we finish, he'll be able to go into re-looking at the question that they are raising of independence and will give us a very solid advice, as he's been able to do since yesterday. So you will get an answer. So don't go back to the question all the time. You'll definitely get an answer of advice about this independence tomorrow before we finalize the bill itself.
That's fine, Chair. Thank you for that. My other proposal is that our research staff look at one or two institutions and that we be briefed on how those institutions are appointed, and I think that there might be some useful alternatives that we could look at that would limit the minister's powers and maximize the independence of the institution. That's one point. The second point is representation on the committee, where we correctly look at racial and gender representation. But I think it's very important that on this committee, at least three, if you like, groups be represented. And that would be individuals who come from, retired, of course, come from the regular services, from the reserve services, and also from the civilian component of the Defence Force. I think we should look at that quite carefully. People who are able to speak with authority about their experience in the Defence Force, either in the regular force, in the reserve force, or in the civilian component of the institution.
Thank you very much, Committee Chairperson. You know, Chairperson, this committee to be male and female, very, very important. But I think we must also look at this thing of affirmative action. Let me, truly speaking, these days, you'll find outside people, they say, apartheid now reverse, by the way. If you are a white or Indian or colored, they're just ignoring you. But I think if you are talking about gender, men and women, but at the same time, we must look also affirmative action on that committee. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, not on these particular issues. Whether the issue of representation, I think, whether we can specify specifically that it must be regular, reserve, or civilian, I think the criteria would need to reflect over the period's particular circumstances. And we accept that in the criteria guiding that, it might be that whether that's regulated or not, it would indicate what is required at the time. But we were not certain that should be included in law, that it must be regular, reserve, or civilian components that constitute necessarily the part. Because the circumstances may be different. In the second term, it might be that you need to nominate people that are differently constituted. I think it's a point to bear in mind, but not necessarily one that would advise legislated specifically. Because once you start legislating this representativity, you would have to specify all others. And it's just a mute point. Once you've said broadly representative, I think we would all understand what that means without specifying the various components. We note the point of the suggestion, but not necessarily suggest any amendment to the legislation as a result. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Actually, it boils down to what I suggested earlier on, that once you specify in regards to males and females, then someone is going to come with another specificity. So that's why I say we should just retain broadly representative. In that case, we must have people with labor background, you know, or army union background. So now I understand Honorable Manir's point is that we should act on these other things. Now, if we say broadly representative, it should be followed by full stop. And I'm just tempted, you know, to comment on the independence, if you allow me. Whatever the outcome of our legal advice, but I don't think we should be held, you know, by independence, because we may hold different views of what is independent. Some people see independent electoral commission as independent. SPC, I don't see it as independent, obviously. So I don't think that we should be bogged down on the independence of that, so long as the system is going to work. Whether it's independent or what, I don't think it should be our concern.
From the back. Now, I don't want to open a discussion today. I was just allowing the member to express his point of view. You have made the point. Let's leave it here now. No, David. Let's move on now. Let's go to 62-2. You still have a chance, David. You see, I did try to prevail on you that if you have made the point and it's been contested, I can't allow a discussion to continue all the time. No, you'll debate it, David. You are finalizing the bill tomorrow. You also have to focus on the bill. The more I allow general politics to be discussed on the bill, then the bill gets delayed.
Jay, what is the outcome that I'm trying to prevent? The outcome that I'm interested in trying to prevent is a commission which might be representative but might have no experience whatsoever of military affairs. Surely we would want, obviously, a mix of skills, but we would want at least commissioners, at least one commissioner who has some experience in the officer corps, perhaps, in the non-commissioned ranks of the Defence Force and perhaps the civilian ranks or the civilian department, who is able to speak authoritatively about conditions in the department. That's my point.
You see, I agree with your point, I don't agree with your point, but I don't want us to go into it now, because we are going to delete it. You have made the submission, and make it the submission to members of parliament, so that when we go to the finality of the bill, they will be able to do. But I also take note of other points that other people are making, that don't go and specify every detail, you might end up knowing. So I'm just trying to solve that broader principle that has been said.
I don't know what Honorable Menir is looking for. Because if you go to 4A, 4A deals directly with his argument. You see? Now, I don't know what he wants. He wants them rather not to say proven skills, knowledge and experience of candidates in matters relevant to the functioning of the commission. That, for me, Chairperson, I think it's adequate enough. But also, Chairperson, I think Honorable Mphahlele is correct in a way that if the committee does agree that 3A, it must only go up to population and exclude and both males and females. Because if you say broadly representative of the South African population, you already have spoken about everything.
No, not necessarily.
Less than females are not part of the population. No, I think we've got to be careful here. We've got to say something about all genders. Even if you don't say females, males and females, but gender issue is a very strong matter in South Africa. And we've got to be stress that point somehow. I don't know what language can be used here. If you to refer to South African population, you are not referring to genders, all genders. You are merely referring to the population, which consists of four main different groups. Namely, the so-called Africans, black Africans, the so-called white, the so-called colored, the so-called Indians. Those are the main population groups of South Africa. Now, if you are saying that, you're not even referring to sectors, sectoral these things. We're not referring to that. But all those things, I believe, in the advertisement for nomination of people, all those things should be taken into consideration. We've got to include the question of gender somewhere. Otherwise, we are in trouble with the women.
Cut yourself quite enough on the issue. Let's move on to page 6. Disqualification from members and removal from office. 62D. Today, must you appoint members of parliament? That's where we are. Is that what it says? I'll use the privilege you gave me that says that silence means that nothing. You mean? How am I going to say that? You mean? You mean? You mean? You mean? You mean? You
What was that? And rehabilitated insolvent. What kind of a person this one? And he did not classify us because he said broadly representative, including the unrehabilitated insolvent. Because I see bourgeoisified legislation here.
Again, the question of the powers of the minister and the independence of the National Defence Force Service Commission. If my reading of this 62D3, the minister may remove a member of the commission from office on account of misconduct, inability to perform duties, etc., etc. It seems a fairly, at least on the reading in this proposed amendment, a very draconian power. I mean, does the minister decide who's inefficient and who has the inability to perform and then just simply parachute in and remove them? I think that we have to be very cautious here. The minister surely would have the power to remove a member, for example, if he or she is guilty of some kind of misconduct, but then presumably the body that determines that a member is guilty of misconduct must be an independent body. Through you, Chair, I'd like the parliamentary legal advisor to look at this clause and perhaps give us an opinion. I mean, if it's the intention of the drafters that the minister parachute in and remove individuals which he or she believes are not performing their duties, I think that there's something fundamentally wrong with that.
Chairperson, you've raised the question whether members of parliament should be part of the commission or members of the commission. I can give you my experience, and I must be honest with you. If members of parliament is going to be members of the commission, somewhere they're going to neglect something. On no other grounds. I mean, if you're a member of parliament, well, in my situation, at one stage, because this commission has got very important things to look at, and sometimes it takes quite a lot of time. And I would suggest that, well, if we have to put it in the bill is one thing, but I think the members, we can discuss it tomorrow, that I think, and I want to put it on record, that members of parliament, I don't see that they will have the time to really give everything of themselves for both the situations. That's the one. And I think I can say to the Honourable Mayor that I understand his mistrust in the minister, but he must always remember that in any removal of any person, there's always common law. I mean, the minister, if she decides that a member is in a bill, it's unable or his inability to perform the duties, it's always common law. She can't just say, listen, I decide that you are unable to perform your duty. She must give the reasons to have discussion. So you can always go to common, as far as common law is concerned, to say that there must be justification in that. I just want to put it on record.
Yeah, my view is similar to that of the general here. That in answer to Comrade David over there, the minister will remove any person either for misconduct or for person being unable to perform his or her duty on the recommendation of something. He can't just parachute into that and, as you put it, and remove that person. There must have been some reports, either from the commission itself complaining about Mlangeni or David not performing his duties, etc., etc. And the minister is there, that minister will come in, not just unilaterally on her own. She's not even serving on the commission. So she will not know unless reports are made to her. That's common sense, my comrade David.
I've been accused of many things, but not lacking common sense. That's new. Chair, the point I wanted to make was actually on the Honourable Groenewald's point about legislators serving on the commission. It would seem to me that there would also be a possible separation of powers problem with legislators serving on the commission, and I think it's something that we should look at and possibly legislate for. In other words, to specifically exclude legislators serving on this commission. I the legislators who did serve on the commission, I'm sure, have done an exemplary job, but I don't think it should be a trend in the future.
Can we can I just get some more information? What does the honourable member mean by separation of powers? Then we're talking about the executive, the legislature, and the judicial. Can you just give me more information? What does he mean by the separation of powers?
Well, my thinking would be that if, for example, the chairperson of the Joint Standing Committee or the Portfolio Committee was also a member of the Commission, they would then be a member of an executive of a body in the executive branch of government and in the legislature. At some point, there might be a conflict because the Portfolio Committee or the Joint Standing Committee, of which that person is a chairperson, would be the body responsible for holding the Defence Force Service Commission to account for the performance of their functions, and that may create a difficulty.
Well, thank you, Chair. Chair, I'd like to go back to the point of the minister having power to remove members of the commission due to misconduct and the other issues. Chair, as the Honourable Mr. Kuneva stated, there are rules of common law, rules of natural justice, Chair, that state that a person has to have a hearing out the alter and partem rule. But, Chair, our system has gone further. So in terms of the Constitution, everyone has the right to a just administrative action that is lawful, reasonable, and procedurally fair. And so to this effect, the legislature came up with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And that act, Chair, applies to all organs of state so that every action that is adversely affecting any individual will have to be just and procedurally fair. Therefore, Chair, the minister won't just dismiss anybody without any reason. That person will have to be afforded an opportunity to state his or her case. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, maybe I asked the question in jest, really, but I'm serious on the question of unrehabilitated insolvents, because I know we are a bourgeois democracy, but that does it mean that people who are victims of this capitalist greedy system should be excluded from the commission?
Yes.
Secondly, 62D, number 2, where do we place the people like Honorable Mlangeni who were imprisoned and they never got the general amnesty. No, you don't qualify legally speaking. where do we place, you know, people who, yeah.
Chairperson, I'm going to ask Ms. Kobushi to deal with the issue of unrehabilitated insolvents. The issue of the conviction would rely on, particularly in relation to convictions in relation to political offences, we would rely on the processes in law that normally would deal with those convictions. And provide for amnesty or other measures, which would basically mean those are no longer offences as defined. But I would think in C, we would have to keep to the offences as are described largely in criminal law and what they refer to in criminal law. If other exceptional circumstances arise, we would have to rely on processes for providing amnesty in relation to them. Particularly in the case of Tatu Mlangeni and many other people. So it's the amnesty that exempts a person. You wouldn't exclude it here in this clause. They would be exempted by the amnesty that they receive.
On the question of unrehabilitated insolvent, an insolvent person is a person who is declared bankrupt in terms of the Insolvency Act. And in order for you, the Insolvency Act prohibits people who have been declared insolvent to perform certain functions. Once you have been declared insolvent, you go through a certain period until you are rehabilitated. So you become a rehabilitated insolvent. Then you can perform the functions that were prohibited by the Insolvency Act. But once, as long as you have not been rehabilitated, you remain an unrehabilitated insolvent. So that is why we have this unrehabilitated insolvent there. You are basically bankrupt.
You can't defend you.
Can I say you must be declared insolvent by a court of law? You cannot just decide that you are insolvent. Even if you don't have money, you can't say you are insolvent yourself. A court must declare you insolvent.
So there's great potential for some of the MPs not to make it. Can I have you, sir?
Chairperson, I just want to come back to 62C. I think the problem has been solved by the last sentence, unless a period of at least 5 years has expired after the date of which the sentence was served. I think it's 16 years since 1994, so I don't think it will be really a problem. If 5 years has after the sentence, then a member can be a member.
He can serve on the commission. No, he's not working hard on the bill because he wants to go to the commission. People are suspicious that you want to become a commissioner. If you agree on that one, it has come to be now lunch time, honorable members. You go to lunch and you come back at 2. I haven't been able to. Can you forgo lunch? No, I know you are enjoying. No, let's give people their privilege because they want to do some few things and some calls. We'll be back here at 2 o'clock, honorable members. We'll go up until 4 o'clock. Then after 4 o'clock, if we can finish, it means then tomorrow we'll just do the voting. And then by 12, we should be finished and done. Those who stay in different provinces. I think we're at the level of finishing up the bill now. We've really sorted out major issues. Let's go for the last, honorable members. Don't call a meeting, stand under again, please. Can you go for lunch now?